has to travel faster. The difference in speed means that the air on the top of the wing exerts less pressure than the air on the bottom, thus helping the bird or airplane to stay aloft. The air above birds is thinner than the usual thinness of the other air, he wrote. Leonardo thus realized, before other scientists, that a bird stays aloft not merely because the wings beat downward against the air, but also because the wings propel the bird forward and the air lessens in pressure as it rushes over the wing's curved top surface. Flying machines. Both his observations on anatomy and his analysis of the physics convinced Leonardo that it was possible to build a winged mechanism that would allow humans to fly. A bird is an instrument working according to mathematical law, and it is in the capacity of man to reproduce such an instrument, he wrote. A man with wings large enough and duly attached might learn to overcome the resistance of the air and raise himself upon it. Combining engineering with physics and anatomy, Leonardo began in the late 1480s to devise contraptions to accomplish this. His first design, see figure 50 in the PDF, looks like a big bowl with four oar-like blades that were to alternate in pairs moving up and down, like the four-winged dragonfly he had studied earlier. To overcome the relative weakness of human breast muscles, this cross between a flying saucer and a health club torture chamber has the operator use his legs to push pedals, his arms to crank a gear and pulley mechanism, his head to pump a piston, and his shoulders to pull cables. It is unclear how he would manage to steer the machine. 7 pages later, in the same notebook, Leonardo produced an elegant drawing of an experiment that used a bat-like wing, its thin bones covered with a membrane of skin rather than feathers, that was similar to those he had drawn for theatrical productions back in Florence. See figure 51. The wing is attached to a thick wooden plank, which, he specified, should weigh 150 pounds, like an average man, and to a lever mechanism that would pump the wing. Leonardo even drew an amusing man in motion jumping up and down on top of the end of the long lever. A little sketch below shows a clever element. When the wing is swinging upward, a hinge allows it to point its tips downward and encounter less resistance, then slowly be moved by a spring and pulley back into a rigid position. Later ideas included devising skin flaps in the wings that would be closed on the downswing but fly open on the upswing to minimize air resistance. At times, Leonardo abandoned the hope of achieving self-propelled flight and designed gliders instead. One of these was shown to be basically workable in a reconstruction done 500 years later by the ITN television network in Britain. However, for most of his career, he remained committed to achieving human-powered flight in bird-like devices with flapping wings. He drew more than a dozen variations, using pedals and levers with the pilot prone or standing, and began referring to his machine as the uccello, or bird. In his spacious accommodations at the Corte Vecchia, Leonardo had what he called la mia fabbrica, my factory. In addition to being the room where he had worked on the ill-fated horse monument for the Sforzas, it provided space for experimenting with flying machines. At one point, he wrote himself a note about how to conduct a flight experiment on the roof without being seen by the workers constructing a tower, the Tiburio that he had failed in the competition to design on the cathedral next door. "Make a large and tall model, and you will have a room on the upper roof," he wrote. "If you stand on the roof at the side of the tower, the men at work upon the Tiburio will not see you." At other times, he envisioned testing a machine over water while wearing a life preserver. "You will experiment with this machine over a lake, and you will wear as a belt a long wineskin, so that if you fall in, you will not drown." And finally, when all of his experiments were nearing an end, he mingled his plans with fantasies. "The large bird will take its first flight from the back of the great swan," he wrote on the last folio of his Codex on the Flight of Birds, referring to Swan Mountain, Monte Ceceri, near Fiesole. "Filling the universe with amazement, filling all writings with its fame, and bringing eternal glory to the nest where it was born. With beautiful little drawings, Leonardo portrayed the elegance of birds as they twisted, turned, shifted their center of gravity, and maneuvered the winds. He also pioneered the use of vector-like lines and swirls to show invisible currents. But for all the beauty of his art and all the ingenuity of his designs, he was never able to create a self-propelled human flying machine. To be fair, after 500 years, nobody else has either. Late in his life, Leonardo sketched a cylinder with two feeble wings, clearly meant as a toy. Look closely, and you can see that it's attached to a wire line. In what may be his last drawing of a mechanical bird, he reverted, in a poignant and slightly sad fashion, to the way he began drawing them 30 years earlier, as dazzling but ephemeral little contraptions for the momentary amusement of audiences at court theatricals and public pageants. Chapter 12. The Mechanical Arts. Machines. Leonardo's interest in machinery was linked to his fascination with motion. He saw both machines and humans as apparatuses designed to move with analogous components such as cords and sinews. As he did with his anatomy drawings of dissected bodies, he drew machines disassembled, using exploded and layered views to show how motion is transferred from gears and levers to wheels and pulleys, and his cross-disciplinary interests allowed him to connect concepts from anatomy to engineering. Other Renaissance technologists drew machines, but they did so by presenting them in completed form without discussing the role and efficiency of each component. Leonardo, on the other hand, was interested in a part-by-part analysis of the transfer of motion, rendering each of the moving parts, ratchets, springs, gears, levers, axles, and so on, was a method to help him understand their functions and engineering principles. He used drawing as a tool for thinking. He experimented on paper and evaluated concepts by visualizing them. Take, for example, his drawing, beautifully shaded and in perfect perspective, of a hoist in which a lever can be rocked to ratchet up toothed wheels and lift a heavy load. See figure 52 in the PDF. It shows how an up-and-down cranking motion can be converted into a continuous rotary motion. The assembled mechanism is on the left side of the page, and to the right is an exploded view of each of the components. Many of his most beautiful and meticulous drawings explore how to make sure that motion stays at a constant pace without slowing down when a coiled spring slowly unwinds. In the beginning, a tightly wound spring transmits a lot of power and causes a mechanism to move quickly. But after a while, it has less power and the mechanism slows down. This can be a serious problem for many devices, especially clocks. A major enterprise of the late Renaissance was finding a way to equalize the power of an unwinding spring. Leonardo pioneered the depiction of gears that solved this challenge by using the spiral forms that fascinated him throughout his life. One particularly elegant drawing, figure 53, shows a spiral gear equalizing the speed of an unwinding barrel spring and transmitting the constant power to a wheel that pushes a shaft steadily upward. The drawing is one of his most gorgeous works. He used his left-handed hatches to show form and shading, with curved hatchings for the barrel. His mechanical ingenuity is combined with his artistic passion for spirals and curls. The key purpose of machinery, then as now, is to harness energy and turn it into movements that accomplish useful tasks. For example, Leonardo showed how the energy of humans could be used to pump a treadmill or turn a crank. That power could then be transmitted by gears and pulleys to perform a function. To capture human energy most efficiently, he broke the human body into components. He illustrated how each muscle works, calculated its power, and showed methods for leveraging it. In a notebook from the 1490s, he calculated how much weight a man can lift with his biceps, legs, shoulders, and other muscle groups. "The greatest force a man can apply," he wrote, "will be when he sets his feet on one end of the balance and then leans his shoulders against some stable support. This will raise, at the other end of the balance, a weight equal to his own, plus as much weight as he can carry on his shoulders. These studies were helpful for determining which muscles, if any, would be best at propelling a manned flying machine. But he also applied his findings to other tasks and sources of power. At one point, he listed the many practical applications that could come from harnessing the power of the Arno River. Sawmills, wool cleaning machines, paper mills, hammers for forges, flour mills, knife grinding and sharpening, burnishing arms, manufacture of gunpowder, the silk spinning power of 100 women, ribbon weaving, shaping vases made from jasper, and more. One of the practical applications he explored was using machinery to drive piles in the banks of a river to regulate its flow. His initial concept was to use a drop hammer that was raised by pulleys and ropes. Later, he came up with an idea for raising the hammer more efficiently by having men climb a ladder and descend in a stirrup. Likewise, when studying how to harness the power of falling water using a water wheel, he realized correctly that it would be efficient to have the water fill buckets that would be pulled by gravity down one side of the wheel. He then designed a ratchet system so that the water would be dumped out of each bucket just as it got to the bottom of the turn. In a further modification, he designed a wheel with buckets in the shape of curved scoops. Leonardo also invented a machine designed to grind needles, which would have been a valuable contribution to the textile industries of Italy. It used human power to revolve a turntable attached to small grinding gears and polishing strips. See figure 54 in the PDF. He thought it might make him rich. "Tomorrow morning, on January 2nd, 1496, I shall try out the broad belt," he wrote in a notebook. He estimated that 100 such machines could turn out 40,000 needles an hour, each of which could be sold for 5 soldi. With a labored set of calculations and a tenfold error in multiplication, he figured that he could reap an annual revenue of 60,000 ducats, the gold equivalent of more than $8 million in 2017. Even allowing for his miscalculation, 6,000 ducats of revenue should have been enticing enough to lure him away from the trade of painting Madonnas and altarpieces. But needless to say, Leonardo never finished executing his plan. Coming up with the conception was enough for him. Perpetual motion. Leonardo understood the concept of what he called impetus, which is what happens when a force pushes an object and gives it momentum. "A body in motion desires to maintain its course in the line from which it started," he wrote. "Every movement tends to maintain itself, or rather, every body in motion continues to move so long as the influence of the force that set it in motion is maintained in it." Leonardo's insights were a precursor to what Newton, 200 years later, would make his first law of motion, that a body in motion will stay in the same motion unless acted upon by another force. If you were able to eliminate all forces slowing down an object in motion, then it should be possible, Leonardo thought, for a body to stay in motion forever. So during the 1490s, he used 28 pages of a notebook to explore the possibility of a perpetual motion machine. He looked for ways to prevent the momentum of an object from draining away, and he studied ways that a system could create or replenish its own impetus. He considered many mechanisms: wheels with hammers on hinges that would swing out when their part of the wheel was heading down, ways to hang weights on wheels that would keep them turning, spiral screws that form a double helix, and curved compartments on a wheel with balls that roll to the lowest point when they are heading downward. He was especially intrigued by the possibility that water devices might be a way to achieve perpetual motion. One such attempt, see figure 55, envisions the use of moving water to turn a coiled tube known as an Archimedes screw, which would carry water upward and then continue turning the screw as it flows downward. Was it possible for the downward flow of water, he asked, to turn the screw with enough power to raise enough water to keep the process going indefinitely? even though technologists would try ways of accomplishing that trick for the next three centuries, Leonardo concluded, clearly and correctly, that it was impossible. Descending water will never raise from its resting place an amount of water equal to its weight. His drawings served as visual thought experiments. By rendering the mechanisms in his notebooks rather than actually constructing them, he could envision how they would work and assess whether they would achieve perpetual motion. He eventually concluded, after looking at many different methods, that none of them would. In reasoning so, he showed that, as we go through life, there is a value in trying to do such tasks as designing a perpetual motion machine. There are some problems that we will never be able to solve, and it's useful to understand why. Among the impossible delusions of man is the search for continuous motion, called by some perpetual wheel, he wrote in the introduction to his Codex Madrid 1. Speculators on perpetual motion, how many vain chimeras you have created in this quest! Friction. What prevents perpetual motion, Leonardo realized, is the inevitable loss of momentum in a system when it rubs against reality. Friction causes energy to be lost and prevents motion from being perpetual. So do air and water resistance, as he knew from his studies of bird flight and fish movement. Thus he began a methodical study of friction, which resulted in some impressive insights. Through a set of experiments with heavy objects moving down a slope, he discovered the relationship among three determinants of friction: the weight of the object, the smoothness or roughness of the incline's surface, and the steepness of the incline. He was among the first to figure out that the amount of friction is not dependent on the size of the area of contact between the object and the surface. The friction made by the same weight will be of equal resistance at the beginning of its movement, although the contact may be of different breadths and lengths, he wrote. These laws of friction, and in particular the realization that friction is independent of the contact surface area, were an important discovery, but Leonardo never published them. They had to be rediscovered almost 200 years later by the French scientific instrument maker Guillaume Amonton. Leonardo then went on to perform experiments to quantify the effects of each factor. To measure the power of an object sliding down an incline, he devised an instrument, now known as a tribometer, that would not be reinvented until the 18th century. Using the device, he analyzed what we now call the coefficient of friction, which is the ratio between the force it takes to move one surface over another and the pressure between the surfaces. For a piece of wood sliding against another piece of wood, he calculated this ratio as 0.25, which is about right. He found that by lubricating the incline, he reduced friction. So he was among the first engineers to include points for the insertion of oil into his mechanical devices. He also devised ways to use ball bearings and roller bearings, techniques that were not commonly used until the late 1800s. In his Codex Madrid 1, which is largely devoted to the design of more efficient machinery, Leonardo drew a new type of screw jack, one of those devices in which a big screw is turned to push upward on a heavy object. See figure 56. These were widely used in the 15th century. One drawback is that there is a lot of friction when a heavy load is pressing down. Leonardo's solution, which was likely the first of its kind, was to put some ball bearings between the plate and the gear, which he drew in an exposed view just to the left of the jack. An even closer schematic view is to the left of that. If a weight of a flat surface moves on a similar surface, its movement will be facilitated by interposing balls or rollers between them, he wrote in the accompanying text. If the balls or rollers touch each other in their motion, they will make the movement more difficult than if there were no contact between them, because when they touch, the friction causes a contrary motion and the movements counteract each other. But if the balls or rollers are kept at a distance from each other, it will be easy to generate this movement. Being Leonardo, he then produced many pages of sketch thought experiments in which he varied the size and arrangements of the ball bearings. Three balls are better than four, he determined, because three points define a plane, and thus the three balls will always touch a flat surface, whereas a fourth ball may be out of alignment. Leonardo was also the first person to record the best mix of metals to produce an alloy that reduces friction. It should be 3 parts of copper and 7 of tin melted together, which was similar to the alloy he was using to make mirrors. Leonardo's formula gives a perfectly working anti-friction composition, wrote Ladislao Reti, the historian of technology who played a role in discovering and publishing the Madrid codices in 1965. Once again, Leonardo was about 3 centuries ahead of his time. The first anti-friction alloy is usually credited to the American inventor Isaac Babbitt, who patented an alloy containing copper, tin, and antimony in 1839. Through his work on machinery, Leonardo developed a mechanistic view of the world foreshadowing that of Newton. All movements in the universe, of human limbs and of cogs in machines, of blood in our veins and of water in rivers, operate according to the same laws, he concluded. These laws are analogous. The motions in one realm can be compared to those in another realm, and patterns emerge. Man is a machine. A bird is a machine. The whole universe is a machine, wrote Marco Chianci in an analysis of Leonardo's devices. As Leonardo and others led Europe into a new scientific age, he ridiculed astrologers, alchemists, and others who believed in non-mechanistic explanations of cause and effect, and he relegated the idea of religious miracles to the purview of priests. Chapter 13. Math. Geometry. Leonardo increasingly came to realize that mathematics was the key to turning observations into theories. It was the language that nature used to write her laws. There is no certainty in sciences where mathematics cannot be applied, he declared. He was correct. Using geometry to understand the laws of perspective taught him how math could extract from nature the secrets of its beauty and reveal the beauty of its secrets. With his visual acuity, Leonardo had a natural feel for geometry, and that branch of math helped him formulate some rules for how nature works. However, his facility with shapes was not matched by one for numbers, so arithmetic did not come naturally. In his notebooks are entries where, for example, he doubles 4,096 to get 8,092, forgetting to carry the one. As for algebra, that wonderful tool for using numbers and letters to codify nature's laws and variables, bequeathed to later Renaissance scholars by the Arabs and Persians, Leonardo was clueless, which hindered his ability to use equations as brushstrokes for painting the patterns he discerned in nature. What Leonardo liked about geometry, as opposed to arithmetic, was that geometric shapes are continuous quantities, whereas numbers are discrete digits and thus discontinuous units. Arithmetic deals with discontinuous quantities, geometry with continuous ones, he wrote. In modern parlance, we would say that he was more comfortable with analog tools, including the use of shapes as analogies. Yes, that's where the word analog comes from, rather than being a digital native. As he wrote, arithmetic is a computational science in its calculation with true and perfect units, but it is of no avail in dealing with continuous quantity. Geometry also had the advantage of being a visual endeavor. It engaged the eye and the imagination. When he looked at the way that shells assumed a helical shape, Martin Kemp wrote, at how leaves and petals originated from stems, and at the reasons why a heart valve worked with perfect economy, geometrical analysis delivered the results he desired. Not having access to algebra, he instead used geometry to describe the rate of change caused by a variable. For example, he used triangles and pyramids to represent rates of change in the velocity of falling objects, the volume of sounds, and the perspective view of distant objects. Proportion is not only to be found in number and measure, but also in sounds, weights, times and places, and every force that exists, he wrote. Luca Pacioli. One of Leonardo's close friends at Milan's court was Luca Pacioli, a mathematician who developed the first widely published system for double-entry bookkeeping. Like Leonardo, he was born in Tuscany and attended only an abacus school, which provided a trade education in arithmetic, but no Latin. He worked as a wandering tutor to boys from wealthy families, and then became a Franciscan friar who never moved into a monastery. He wrote a math textbook in Italian, rather than Latin, which was published in Venice in 1494. It thus became part of the explosive spread of learning in vernacular languages triggered by the printing press in the late 15th century. Leonardo bought a copy as soon as it was published, recording the rather high cost, more than twice what he paid for a Bible, in his notebook, and he may have helped recruit Pacioli to become part of the Milan court. The mathematician arrived there in about 1496 and had living quarters along with Leonardo at the Corte Vecchia. They shared a love of geometric shapes. A portrait painted of Pacioli, see figure 57 in the PDF, shows him and a student in front of a table with a protractor, compass, and stylus. A polyhedron of 18 squares and 8 triangles, half filled with water, dangles from the ceiling. A lesser-known but important component of Pacioli's work at court involved contributing, alongside Leonardo, to its ephemeral amusements and performances. In a notebook he began just after his arrival, on the powers of numbers, Pacioli compiled riddles, mathematical brain twisters, magic tricks, and parlor games designed to be presented and solved at court parties. His tricks include how to make an egg walk across a table. It involves wax and strands of hair. How to make a coin go up and down in a glass, vinegar and magnetic powder. And how to make a chicken jump, quicksilver. His parlor games included the first published version of the standard card trick of guessing which card someone has picked from a deck. It involves an accomplice. Brain teasers such as one in which a man has to figure out how to ferry a wolf and a goat and a cabbage across a river. And math games in which a spectator thinks of a number which can then be discovered by asking the result of a few operations performed on it. Particularly appealing to Leonardo were Pacioli's games involving creating circles around triangles and squares using only a ruler and a compass. Pacioli and Leonardo bonded over their shared fondness for such stimulating amusements and entertainments. Leonardo's name crops up often in Pacioli's notes. After writing the basics of one trick, for instance, Pacioli declares, "Well, Leonardo, you can do more of this on your own." More seriously, Leonardo learned math from Pacioli, a great tutor, who taught him the subtleties and beauties of Euclid's geometry and tried to teach him, with less success, how to multiply squares and square roots. At times, when he found a concept difficult to comprehend, Leonardo would copy passages of Pacioli's explanations verbatim into his notebooks. Leonardo returned the favor by drawing a set of mathematical illustrations of astonishing artistic beauty and grace for the book Pacioli began writing upon his arrival in Milan. On Divine Proportion, which examines the role of proportions and ratios in architecture, art, anatomy, and math. Given Leonardo's appreciation for the intersection of arts and sciences, he was fascinated by the topic. Most of Leonardo's drawings for Pacioli's book, which was finished in 1498, are variations of the five shapes known as Platonic solids. These are polyhedrons that have the same number of faces meeting at each vertex: pyramids, cubes, octahedrons, 8 faces, dodecahedrons, 12, and icosahedrons, 20. He also illustrated more complex shapes, such as a rhombocubo-octahedron, which has 26 facets, 8 of them equilateral triangles that are bordered by squares. See figure 58. He pioneered a new method for making such shapes understandable. Instead of drawing them as solids, he made them see-through skeletons, as if constructed of wooden beams. His 60 illustrations for Pacioli were the only drawings he published during his lifetime. Part of Leonardo's genius is in the lighting and shading of these illustrations, which make the geometric renderings seem like actual objects dangling before our eyes. The light comes in from an angle, casting shadows both bold and subtle. Each of the object's faces becomes a window pane. Leonardo's mastery of perspective added to the three-dimensional look. He could envision the shapes in his head as real objects, then convey them on the page. but he probably also used actual wooden models that he hung on a string, like the dangling polyhedron in the portrait of Pacioli. Using both observation and mathematical reasoning, and combining his study of geometric shapes with his inquiries into the flight of birds, Leonardo became the first person to discover the center of gravity of a triangular pyramid, one quarter of the way up a line from the base to the peak. In his book, Pacioli gratefully acknowledged that the drawings were made and formed by the ineffable left hand so well versed in all the mathematical disciplines by the prince among mortals today, by the first Florentine, our Leonardo da Vinci, who in that happy time, together with me, on the same stipends, was in the marvellous city of Milan. Pacioli later called Leonardo the most worthy of painters, perspectivists, architects and musicians, one endowed with every perfection. And he recalled, that happy time when we were both in the employ of the most illustrious Duke of Milan, Ludovico Maria Sforza Anglo, in the years of our Lord 1496 to 1499. Pacioli's book focused on the golden ratio, or divine proportion, an irrational number that expresses a ratio that pops up often in number series, geometry and art. It is approximately 1.61803398, but, being irrational, has decimals that stretch on randomly forever. The golden ratio occurs when you divide a line into two parts in such a way that the ratio between the whole length and the longer part is equal to the ratio between the longer part and the shorter part. For example, take a line that's 100 inches long and divide it into two parts of 61.8 inches and 38.2 inches. That comes close to the golden ratio because 100 divided by 61.8 is about the same as 61.8 divided by 38.2. In both cases, it's approximately 1.618. Euclid wrote about this ratio in around 300 BC, and it has fascinated mathematicians ever since. Pacioli was the first to popularize the name divine proportion for it. In his book by that title, he described the way it turns up in studies of geometric solids such as cubes and prisms and polyhedrons. In popular lore, including in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, the golden ratio is found throughout Leonardo's art. If so, it is doubtful it was intentional. Although it is possible to draw diagrams of the Mona Lisa and Saint Jerome asserting this notion, the evidence that Leonardo consciously made use of the precise mathematical ratio is not convincing. Nevertheless, Leonardo's interest in harmonic ratios was reflected in his intense studies of the ways that ratios and proportions are manifest in anatomy, science, and art. It led him to search for analogies between the proportions of the body, the notes of musical harmonies, and other ratios that underpin the beauty manifest in the works of nature. Transformation of shapes. As an artist, Leonardo was particularly interested in how the shapes of objects transformed when they moved. From his observations on the flow of water, he developed an appreciation for the idea of the conservation of volume. As a quantity of water flows, its shape changes, but its volume remains exactly the same. Understanding the transformation of volumes was useful for an artist, especially one such as Leonardo, who specialized in portraying bodies in motion. It helped him picture how an object's shape could be distorted or transformed while keeping its volume unchanged. "Of everything that moves," he wrote, "the space which it acquires is as great as that which it leaves." This applies not only to quantities of water, but to a bending arm and twisting torso of a human. As he became more interested in how geometry could provide analogies for phenomena in nature, Leonardo began to explore more theoretical cases where the conservation of volume held true as one geometric shape morphed into another. An example would be if you took a square and transformed it into a circle with the exact same area. A three-dimensional example would be showing how a sphere could be transformed into a cube with the same volume. By grappling with these transformations and persistently recording his insights, Leonardo helped to pioneer the field of topology, which looks at how shapes and objects can undergo transformations while keeping some of the same properties. Throughout his notebooks, we can see him, sometimes with obsessive focus, at other times distracted and doodling, taking curved shapes and transforming them into rectangular shapes of the same size, or doing the same for pyramids and cones. He could visualize and draw such transformations, and he sometimes replicated them experimentally using soft wax. But he was not good at the math tools of geometry, which involved being able to multiply the squares of numbers, square roots, cubes, and cube roots. "Learn the multiplication of roots from Maestro Luca," he wrote in his notebook, referring to Pacioli. But he never mastered the math, and instead spent his career trying to figure out geometrical transformations using drawings rather than equations. He started collecting his studies on this topic, and in 1505 declared his intention to write a book entitled Transformation, namely of one body into another without diminishing or increasing the material. Like his other treatises, it produced brilliant notebook pages, but not a published book. Squaring the circle. One topic related to the conservation of volume that particularly intrigued Leonardo and would eventually obsess him came from the ancient Greek mathematician Hippocrates. It involves a lune, a geometric shape that looks like the crescent of a quarter moon. Hippocrates discovered a delightful mathematical fact. If you create a lune by overlapping a large half circle with a smaller one, you can construct a right triangle inside the larger half circle that has the exact same area as the lune. This was the first way discovered to calculate the exact area inside a curved shape, such as a circle or a lune, and to replicate that area in a straight-sided shape, such as a triangle or rectangle. That fascinated Leonardo. He filled his notebooks with shaded drawings in which he overlapped two half circles and then created triangles and rectangles that had the same area as the resulting crescents. Year after year, he relentlessly pursued ways to create circular shapes with areas equivalent to triangles and rectangles, as if addicted to the game. Though he never gave the precise dates of any milestones he reached when making a painting, he treated these geometric studies as if each little success was a moment in history worthy of a notarial record. One night he wrote momentously, "Having for a long time searched to square the angle to two equal curves, now in the year 1509, on the eve of the calends of May, April 30th, I have found the solution at the 22nd hour on Sunday." His pursuit of equivalent areas was aesthetic as well as intellectual. After a while, his experimental geometric shapes, such as his curved triangles, became artistic patterns. On one set of pages, see figure 59, he drew 180 diagrams of overlapping circular and straight-sided shapes, each one annotated with how the shaded and unshaded portions relate to each other in area. As usual, he decided to put together a treatise on the topic, De Ludo Geometrico, he called it, on the game of geometry, and it filled page after page of his notebooks. Not surprisingly, it joined his other treatises in never being finished for publication. His choice of the word ludo is interesting. It implies a diversion, or pastime that is engrossing but like a game. Indeed, the distraction that came from playing with lunes seemed to drive him to lunacy at times. But to him it was an enthralling mind game, one that he believed would get him closer to the secrets of nature's beautiful patterns. These obsessions led Leonardo to an ancient riddle described by Vitruvius, Euripides, and others. Faced with a plague in the 5th century BC, the citizens of Delos consulted the Oracle of Delphi. They were told that the plague would end if they found a mathematical way to precisely double the size of the altar to Apollo, which was shaped as a cube. When they doubled the length of each side, the plague worsened. The oracle explained that by doing so, they had increased the size of the cube eightfold rather than doubling it. For example, a cube with 2-foot sides has 8 times the volume of a cube with 1-foot sides. To solve the problem geometrically, required multiplying the length of each side by the cube root of 2. Despite his note to himself to learn the multiplication of roots from Maestro Luca, Leonardo was never good at square roots, much less cube roots. Even if he had been, however, neither he nor the plague-stricken Greeks had the tools to solve the problem with numerical calculations, because the cube root of 2 is an irrational number. But Leonardo was able to come up with a visual solution. The answer can be found by drawing a cube that is constructed on a plane that cuts diagonally through the original cube, just as a square can be doubled in size by constructing a new square on a line cutting it in half diagonally, thus squaring the hypotenuse. Leonardo also wrestled with a related riddle, the most famous of the ancient math puzzles, squaring the circle. The challenge is to take a circle and, using only a compass and ruler, construct a square that has the exact same area. That quest was what led Hippocrates to work on ways to turn a circular shape into a triangular one with the same volume. For more than a decade, Leonardo became obsessed by the effort. We now know that a mathematical process for squaring a circle requires use of a transcendental number, in this case pi, which cannot be expressed as a fraction and is not the root of any polynomial with rational coefficients. So it's not possible to accomplish it with just a compass and ruler. But Leonardo's persistent efforts show the brilliance of his thought process. At one point, exhausted but excited after an all-night effort, he scribbled one of the momentous entries he used for what he thought were mathematical breakthroughs. On the night of St. Andrew, November 30th, I reached the end of squaring the circle, and at the end of the light of the candle, of the night, and of the paper on which I was writing, it was completed. But it was a false celebration, and he was soon back at work on different methods. One approach he took was to calculate the area of a circle experimentally. He sliced a circle into thin triangular wedges and tried to measure the size of each. He also unrolled the circumference to figure out its length. A more sophisticated approach came from his love of lunes. He cut a circle into many rectangles that could be easily measured and then used the methods of Hippocrates to find areas comparable to the remaining curved parts. Yet another prolonged attempt involved dividing a circle into many sectors, which he then subdivided into triangles and semicircles. He arranged these slices into a rectangle and repeated the process with smaller and smaller slices, approaching the limit of infinitely small triangles. His impulses prefigured those that would lead to the development of calculus, but Leonardo did not have the skills that allowed Leibniz and Newton to devise this mathematical study of change 2 centuries later. Throughout his life, Leonardo would remain enchanted by the transformation of shapes. The margins of his notebooks, and sometimes entire pages, would be filled with triangles inside semicircles, inside squares, inside circles, as he played with tricks for turning one geometrical form into another with the same area or volume. He came up with 169 formulas for squaring a circular shape, and on one sheet drew so many examples that it looks like a page from a pattern book. Even the very last notebook page that he is known to have written near the end of his life, a famous one ending with the phrase, "The soup is getting cold," is filled with triangles and rectangles as he tried to calculate comparable areas. Kenneth Clark once called them calculations which are of no interest to mathematicians and of even less interest to the art historian. Yes, but they were interesting to Leonardo. Compulsively so. They may not have led to historic breakthroughs in mathematics, but they were integral to his ability to perceive and portray motion, of bird wings and water, of a squirming baby Jesus and a breast-beating Saint Jerome, like no other artist before him. Chapter 14. The Nature of Man. Anatomical Drawings, First Period, 1487 to 1493. As a young painter in Florence, Leonardo studied human anatomy primarily to improve his art. His forerunner as an artist engineer, Leon Battista Alberti, had written that Anatomical study was essential for an artist because properly depicting people and animals requires beginning with an understanding of their insides. Isolate each bone of the animal, on this add its muscles, then clothe all of it with its flesh, he wrote in On Painting, which became a Bible for Leonardo. Before dressing a man, we first draw him nude, then we enfold him in draperies. So in painting, the nude, we place first his bones and muscles, which we then cover with flesh, so that it is not difficult to understand where each muscle is beneath. Leonardo embraced the advice with an enthusiasm that any other artist, or for that matter most anatomists, would have found unimaginable. And in his notebooks he preached the same sermon. It is necessary for a painter to be a good anatomist, so that he may be able to design the naked parts of the human frame and know the anatomy of the sinews, nerves, bones, and muscles. Following another part of Alberti's creed, Leonardo wanted to know how psychological emotions led to physical motions. As a result, he would also become interested in the way the nervous system works and how optical impressions are processed. The most basic anatomical knowledge for a painter is the understanding of muscles, and in this Florence's artists were pioneers. Antonio del Pollaiuolo made an influential copperplate engraving of a battle scene of nude men showing their muscles in more than full glory around 1470, when Leonardo was associated with Verrocchio's nearby workshop. Vasari wrote that Pollaiuolo dissected many bodies to study their anatomy, though it's likely these were merely surface studies. Leonardo, who probably observed some of these dissections, naturally soon became interested in exploring even more deeply, and he began what would be a lifelong association with Florence's Hospital of Santa Maria Nuova. When he moved to Milan, he discovered that the study of anatomy there was pursued primarily by medical scholars rather than by artists. The city's culture was more intellectual than artistic, and the University of Pavia was a center for medical research. Prominent anatomical scholars were soon tutoring him, lending him books, and then teaching him dissection. Under their influence, he began pursuing anatomy as a scientific as well as an artistic endeavor. But he did not regard these as separate. In anatomy, as in so many of his studies, he saw the art and science as interwoven. Art required a deep understanding of anatomy, which in turn was aided by a profound appreciation for the beauty of nature. As with his study of the flight of birds, Leonardo went from seeking knowledge that could be of practical use and began seeking knowledge for its own sake, out of pure curiosity and joy. This was evident when he sat down after 7 years in Milan with a clean notebook sheet and made a list of the topics he wished to investigate. On top he wrote the date, on the 2nd of April, 1489, which was unusual for him and an indication that he was embarking on an important endeavor. On the left-hand page he drew, with delicate strokes of a pen, two views of a human skull with veins. On the right-hand page he listed topics to explore. What nerve is the cause of the eye's movement and makes the movement of one eye move the other? Of closing the eyelid, of raising the eyebrows, of parting the lips with teeth clenched, of bringing the lips to a point, of laughing, of expressing wonder. Set yourself to describe the beginning of man when he is created in the womb and why an infant of 8 months does not live. What sneezing is, what yawning is, epilepsy, spasm, paralysis, fatigue, hunger, sleep, thirst, sensuality, of the nerve that causes the movement of the thigh, and from the knee to the foot and from the ankle to the toes. The list begins with inquiries, such as how eyes move and lips smile, that could be useful for his art. But by the time the list gets to an infant in a womb and the cause of sneezing, it is clear that he's looking for more than information that might help his brush. That intermingling of artistic and scientific interests is even more evident on another page that he began writing around the same time. With a sweeping scope ranging from conception to mirth, to music, that would have seemed audacious for anyone other than Leonardo, he outlined a treatise on anatomy that he hoped to produce. This work should begin with the conception of man and describe the nature of the womb and how the fetus lives in it, up to what stage it resides there, and in what way it quickens into life and gets food. Also its growth and what interval there is between one stage of growth and another. What forces it out from the body of the mother and for what reasons it sometimes comes out of the mother's womb before the due time. Then I will describe which parts grow more than the others after the baby is born and determine the proportions of a child of 1 year. Then describe the fully grown man and woman with their proportions and the nature of their complexions, color, and physiognomy. Then how they are composed of veins, tendons, muscles, and bones. Then, in 4 drawings, represent 4 universal conditions of men. That is, mirth, with various acts of laughter and describe the cause of laughter, weeping in various aspects with its causes, fighting, with various acts of killing, flight, fear, ferocity, boldness, murder, and everything pertaining to such cases. Then represent labor, with pulling, thrusting, carrying, stopping, supporting, and such like things. Then perspective, concerning the functions and effects of the eye, and of hearing. Here I will speak of music, and describe the other senses. In subsequent notes, he described how tissue, veins, muscles, and nerves should be shown from a variety of angles. Every part will be drawn using all means of demonstrations from 3 different points of view. For when you have seen a limb from the front, with any muscles, sinews, or veins which take their rise from the opposite side, the same limb will be shown to you in a side view or from behind, exactly as if you had that same limb in your hand and were turning it from side to side until you had acquired a full comprehension of all you wish to know. Thus did Leonardo pioneer a new form of anatomical drawing, perhaps better described in his case as anatomical art, that is still in use today. The skull drawings. Leonardo's initial anatomy studies of 1489 focused on human skulls. He started with a skull that had been sawed in half, top to bottom. See figure 60 in the PDF. Then the front of the left half was sawed off. His groundbreaking technique of drawing the 2 halves together made it easy to see how the inner cavities were positioned relative to the face. For example, the frontal sinus, which Leonardo is the first person to correctly depict, is shown to rest just behind the eyebrow. To appreciate how ingenious this pictorial technique is, cover the right side of the picture with your hand and notice how much less informative the drawing becomes. The originality of the skull drawings of 1489 is so fundamentally different and superior to all other extant illustrations of the time that they are completely out of character with the age, according to Francis Wells, a surgeon and an expert on the anatomical drawings. To the left of the face, Leonardo drew each of the 4 types of human teeth, with a note saying that a human typically has 32, including the wisdom teeth. With this, as far as is now known, he became the first person in history to describe fully the human dental elements, including a depiction of the roots that is almost perfect. The 6 upper molars have 3 roots each, of which 2 roots are on the outer side of the jaw and 1 on the inner, he wrote, evidence that he had cut through the wall of a sinus to determine the position of the roots. If there were not so much else to remember him for, Leonardo could have been celebrated as a pioneer of dentistry. In one of the accompanying drawings, Leonardo showed a skull from the left side with a top quarter section and then the entire left side sawed off. See figure 61. What's most striking in the pen and ink drawing is its artistic beauty. Fine lines, elegant contours, sfumato effects, trademark left-handed cross-hatching, and subtle shadings and shadows adding 3 dimensionality. Among Leonardo's many contributions to science was showing how concepts could be developed through drawing. Beginning with the drapery studies done in Verrocchio's studio, Leonardo mastered the art of rendering light hitting rounded and curved objects. Now he was deploying that art to transform and make beautiful the study of anatomy. On this and another of his skull drawings, Leonardo drew a set of axis lines. At their intersection, near the center of the brain, he located the cavity that he thought contained the senso comune, or confluence of the senses. The soul seems to reside in the judgment, and the judgment would seem to be seated in that part where all the senses meet, and this is called the senso comune, he wrote. In order to link the movements of the mind to the movements of the body, showing how emotions become motions, Leonardo wanted to locate where that phenomenon occurred. In a series of drawings, he attempted to show how visual observations come in through the eye, are processed, and then are sent to the senso comune, where the mind can act on them. The resulting brain signals, he surmised, are transported through the nervous system to the muscles. In most of his drawings, he gave primacy to sight. The other senses did not have a ventricle of their own. On one drawing from this period, showing the bones and nerves of an arm, he drew a faint sketch of the spinal cord and nerves emerging from it. Appended is a note about his experience pithing a frog, the first scientist to record doing what is now a staple of biology classes. "The frog dies instantly when its spinal cord is perforated," he wrote, "and previously it lived without head, without heart, or any interior organs, or intestines, or skin. Here, therefore, it appears, lies the foundation of movement and life." He repeated the experiment on a dog. His drawings of the nerves and spinal cord are clearly labelled. It was not until 1739 that this pithing experiment would again be illustrated and described correctly. In the mid-1490s, Leonardo put aside his work on anatomy. He would not return to the subject for another decade. Although he was neither fully original nor correct in his description of a senso comune, he was right in his general view that the human brain receives visual and other stimuli, processes them into perceptions, then transmits reactions through the nervous system to the muscles. More important, his fascination with the connection between the mind and the body became a key component of his artistic genius, showing how inner emotions are manifest in outward gestures. In painting, the actions of the figures are in all cases expressive of the purpose of their minds, he wrote. As he was finishing his first round of anatomical studies, he was beginning work on what would be the greatest expression in the history of art of that maxim, the Last Supper. Studies of Human Proportion. While studying Vitruvius for his work on the Milan and Pavia cathedrals, Leonardo became captivated by the ancient Roman architect's detailed studies of human proportions and measurements. In addition, when he was measuring horses for the Sforza monument, he became interested in how they related to human proportions. Comparative anatomy appealed to his instinct for finding patterns across different subjects. So, in 1490, he began measuring and drawing the proportions of the human body. Using at least a dozen young men as models in his Corte Vecchia studios, he measured each body part from head to toe and produced more than 40 drawings and 6,000 words. His descriptions included both the average size of body parts and the proportional relationships between different parts. "The space between the mouth and the base of the nose is 1/7 of the face," he wrote. "The space from the mouth to the bottom of the chin is 1/4 of the face and equal to the width of the mouth. The space from the chin to the base of the nose is 1/3 of the face and equal to the length of the nose and to the forehead." These descriptions and others were accompanied by detailed drawings and diagrams with letters denoting the different measurements. See figures 62 and 63. Page after page of his notebooks, 51 sections in all, are filled with ever more precise detail. His descriptions were inspired by Vitruvius, but they went far deeper and were based on his own observations. A small sample of his findings. The distance from the top of the nose to the bottom of the chin is 2/3 of the face. The width of the face is equal to the space between the mouth and the roots of the hair and is 1/12 of the whole height. From the top of the ear to the top of the head is equal to the distance from the bottom of the chin to the duct of the eye and also equal to the distance from the angle of the chin to that of the jaw. The hollow of the cheekbone occurs halfway between the tip of the nose and the top of the jawbone. The great toe is the 6th part of the foot, taking the measure in profile. From the joint of one shoulder to the other is the length of 2 faces. From the navel to the genitals is a face's length. I am tempted to quote him at even greater length because the enormity of his feet and what it says about his compulsive mind is evident not in each measurement, but in the staggering accumulation of them. He goes on and on, relentlessly. In one entry alone, there are at least 80 such calculations or proportions. It becomes both dazzling and dizzying. One tries to imagine him in his studio with measuring string and a handful of compliant assistants dutifully having every body part recorded. Such obsession is a component of genius. Leonardo was not content merely to measure every aspect of every body part. In addition, he felt compelled to record what occurs when each of these parts moves. What happens to the relative shape of each human feature when a joint moves or a person twists? Observe how the position of the shoulder changes when the arm moves up and down, inwards and outwards, to the back and to the front, and also in circular movements and any others, he instructs himself in his notebook, and do the same with reference to the neck, hands and feet and the breast. We can picture him in his studio as he made his models move, turn, squat, sit and lie down. When the arm is bent, the fleshy part shrinks to 2/3 of its length, he recorded. When a man kneels down, he will diminish by the 4th part of his height. When a heel is raised, the tendon and ankle get closer to each other by a finger's breadth. When a man sits down, the distance from his seat to the top part of his head will be half of his height, plus the thickness and length of the testicles. Plus the thickness and length of the testicles? Once again, it is useful to pause and marvel. Why the obsessiveness? Why the need for reams of data? Partly, at least initially, it was to help him paint humans, or horses, in various poses and movements. But there was something grander involved. Leonardo had set for himself the most magnificent of all tasks for the mind of mankind. Nothing less than knowing fully the measure of man and how he fits into the cosmos. In his notebook he proclaimed his intention to fathom what he called Universale Misura dell'Uomo, the universal measure of man. It was the quest that defined Leonardo's life, the one that tied together his art and his science. Chapter 15. Virgin of the Rocks. The Commission. When Leonardo first came to Milan in 1482, he had hopes of working primarily as a military and civil engineer, as he had proposed in his letter to the de facto Duke Ludovico Sforza. That did not happen. Most of his work for the court during the ensuing decade was as a theatrical impresario, then as the sculptor of the unfinished horse monument and a consultant on church designs. Yet his primary talent remained that of a painter, as had been the case in Florence